We could sing two rounds of that. It's okay. It's like once the door closes, we can stop. Okay, so I think everybody here knows a lot about Eleanor Roosevelt. So I'm going to do things a little bit differently. I'm not going to try to give a laundry list of all her accomplishments, although I definitely will hit some of them. but I found that there's no better way to understand Eleanor Roosevelt than by reading her own words and in stories about her. I have a book, a very small book, With Love, Aunt Eleanor, which is basically a family scrapbook written by her niece and namesake, Eleanor Roosevelt II. The dedication to this book reads, "To Aunt Eleanor, my dear friend and mentor, whose compassion led her to world leadership." Now that is really something for someone to say, that I don't think anyone could really put that better. Eleanor herself was very fond of creating little epigrams or thoughts such as, "No one can make you feel inferior without your consent," or "Never allow a person to tell you no who doesn't have the power to say yes." And there are many more of these. Recently, I visited Eleanor Roosevelt's cottage, Valkill, which is right up near Hyde Park at the Eleanor Roosevelt National Historic Site, and was given a tour there. At one point, we were shown a simple desk that she used for many years while keeping up her correspondence. On the desk was a nameplate that was given to her by a young boy who had made it in his school shop. Unfortunately, her first name was misspelled, which was in fact a fairly frequent occurrence in her many years of travel. When she would go places, people would be carrying signs and her name would be misspelled. Afterward, she was asked why she left the nameplate on her desk for years despite the misspelling. Her answer was, that boy might visit her home again, and it would hurt his feelings if he did not see it there. So to me, that's really a sign of her rare sense of compassion that extended not only to children, but to everyone. Her commitment to economic opportunity for women and other working people is well known, as is her commitment to human rights for refugees and people all around the world. She ignored the vilification she so often received for having the temerity to visit with and encourage American black people to improve themselves and their lives, especially in the South. She often engaged world leaders, most famously Nikita Khrushchev, who visited her home in Valkill and was quite shocked that the first lady of the world lived in a simple cottage. There wasn't even enough space in there for him to fit his whole entourage of bodyguards. Coming back to Eleanor in her own words, one book that was particularly interesting to me is Tomorrow Is Now, which she worked hard to complete before the end of her life in 1962. When I started working on this talk, I thought I knew a lot about Eleanor Roosevelt, but it was only when I read that book and a few others that she wrote later in life that I began to appreciate the systematic way in which she applied her values to the times. It was as though she were reaching forward in time to counsel us, which I think is what she intended, although she may not have presumed to think that her writings would be republished and read over 50 years later. Many of the chapters of Tomorrow Is Now could have been written yesterday and concerned ways of thinking still present today, such as rugged individualism, that she felt were outmoded by a century in 1960. Yet she was not pessimistic. Instead, she always sounded a call to action. Her view was that inaction rarely solves problems. The problems we face are in large part the problems of human nature, which have to be constantly reframed for the times and recontested. Today, I'd like to talk a little bit about Eleanor Roosevelt's life and about her views on issues of war and peace, the role of the United Nations, and how we have to adapt our thinking to new conditions as they arise. Eleanor Roosevelt was the first lady of both New York State and the United States. She was a mother of six, authored a daily newspaper column, had radio and television programs, wrote and delivered hundreds of speeches, many thousands of letters, and 27 books. It was President Harry Truman who, referring to her long career and work on refugee issues and at the United Nations, called her the First Lady of the World. Most people would be satisfied to have had any one of these accomplishments or titles, but for Eleanor, it was natural to do them all. So I'm going to start with a little bit about her early life, which was a little bit tragic. Few people who knew Eleanor as a young child would have thought that she would have such a life and career. Most women of that era stayed in the home. She was considered by her mother to be an unattractive child. By the age of two, her mother had given her a nickname based on her serious and shy demeanor. She would say things like, "Eleanor is such a funny child, so old-fashioned, that we always call her Granny." Later on, probably looked like an old lady. Later on, when Anna realized that her daughter did not inherit her family's looks, but instead she looked like a Roosevelt, she said to Eleanor, "You have no looks, so see to it that you have manners." This type of treatment, of course, was humiliating. Imagine. As was her father's frequent absence from the home, due to his penchant for travel, an extramarital affair, and alcoholism. None of these things were ever explained to her, and as a result, she invented her own reasons for the family's distress, mostly blaming her mother. She later said, "If people only realized what a war goes on in a child's mind and heart in a situation of this kind, I think they would try to explain more than they do. But nobody told me anything." Eleanor's first nursemaid was a French woman, and Eleanor learned to speak French before she learned English. Although she did have daily lessons and at one point was enrolled in a convent school, she was extremely awkward socially and uncooperative. When at age seven, Eleanor visited the family home in Tivoli, New York, her great aunt Elizabeth Ludlow was shocked to learn that she could not read or write. Back in their New York City home, lessons began in earnest, including sewing and other skills, but with the exception of cooking. A schoolroom was set up on the third floor, and Anna hired Frederick Roser to tutor Eleanor and the daughters of several friends, some of whom were from other prominent families, and with whom she would work later in life. There are many stories of the creative methods Eleanor used as a child to get attention. She later said, "I now realize I was a great trial to my mother." Her mother, Anna Roosevelt, died when Eleanor was only 8 years old. By that point, Eleanor was living with her grandmother in Tivoli. Her father was largely absent and died shortly before Eleanor's 10th birthday. Eleanor's life, while rich in the natural beauty of Tivoli, began to take on a kind of dreamy quality in which she fantasized about the father she had adored and the many promises of adventures together that he had made to her. In the first version of her memoir, published in 1937, she dedicated the book in part to the memory of my father who fired a child's imagination. At the age of 15, she was sent to boarding school at Allenswood in Wimbledon Park near London. It was then that Eleanor began to blossom. She adored the founder and headmistress of the school, Mademoiselle Souvestre, who was also French, and one of the rules was that French had to be spoken at all times. Upon entering the dining room in the evening, a girl had to report herself if at any time during the day she had uttered an English word. Eleanor later recounted that this was quite easy for her, but for the English girls, it was a terrible effort. One of her schoolmates reminisced, "I remember the day she arrived at the school, and she was so much more grown up than we were. At her first meal, when we hardly dared open our mouths, she sat opposite Mademoiselle Souvestre, chatting away in French." In 1902, when Eleanor turned 18, her formal education was ended when her grandmother insisted that she must have her debut, and so Eleanor returned to New York City. She began her life in public service that same year when she joined some of her friends, including Mary Harriman and others at the Junior League. These young women largely tried to help out the new working class of the city, many of whom were immigrants. I have a little section of this book that I wanted to read. Many of Eleanor's most gratifying hours during this period were spent in volunteer work. In 1900, while still freshman at Barnard, Mary Harriman and other prominent ladies, I'm going to skip this part, had been moved to action by the dreadful crowding, lack of sanitation, cruel working conditions, frequent epidemics, and general misery that faced New York's poor and immigrant populations. They decided to join their middle-class sisters in an effort to create centers for social reform. According to Gladys Vanderbilt, the members of the Junior League were admired, fashionable, and beyond mockery. They were smart, and they made it smart. Several of these women, although 2 years older than Eleanor, had been among her closest friends and Roser's schoolmates. And in 1903, she decided to participate actively in the work of the league. There was no clubhouse, she said. We were just a group of girls anxious to do something helpful in the city in which we lived. At around the same time, she began a relationship with a fifth cousin, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and they married in 1905. They started a family, and Franklin began his steady ascent of the ladder of politics, first in the New York State Senate, then as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, the same job Eleanor's uncle Theodore Roosevelt had held. FDR ran unsuccessfully for vice president in 1920, and in 1921 he was stricken with polio. He began his political comeback in 1924 by placing Al Smith's name in nomination at the Democratic National Convention. He was elected governor of New York in 1928 and president of the United States in 1932. In all of these things, Eleanor was at his side, going back and forth between the halls of power and the common person, learning from political masters such as Lewis Howe. I apologize, I can't find this reference, but there's this amazing little story where she and her friends had tried to put a bill through that was going to benefit, you know, working people or women or something like that, and they had an agreement by more than half of the legislators that they would vote for this bill. But when the time came to vote, they noticed that a lot of the legislators were going to this little door in the State House. It turned out that the manufacturers and others who were opposed to this bill had set up a little mini bar in there and provided refreshments. So after that, you know, they began to realize that they were going to have to get a little bit more sophisticated in how they worked. So that's just an example. I mean, she was obviously incredibly effective at getting things done, and I don't really have to list all of her accomplishments. I will say that by 1936, after over three decades in the public sphere, Eleanor was in a position to offer advice to women who wanted to enter the wider world. You cannot take anything personally. You cannot bear grudges. You must finish the day's work when the day's work is done. You cannot get discouraged too easily. You have to take defeat over and over again and pick up and go on. Be sure of your facts. Argue the other side with a friend until you have found the answer to every point which might be brought up against you. Women who are willing to be leaders must stand out and be shot at. More and more they are going to do it, and more they should do it. Finally, every political woman needs to develop skin as tough as rhinoceros hide. In 1938, Eleanor published a small book entitled This Troubled World, in which the problems of war and peace are considered. I mean, at this time, World War II was coming very close, and there was already fighting going on in China with Japan. So I just want to read this summary, just to get an idea of how Eleanor applied her way of thinking. She said, "We can establish no real trust between nations until we acknowledge the power of love above all other power. We cannot cast out fear, and therefore we cannot build up trust. Perfectly obvious and perfectly true, but we are back again to our fundamental difficulty. the education of the individual human being, and that takes time. We cannot sit around a table and discuss our difficulties until we are able to state them frankly. We must feel that those who listen wish to get at the truth and desire to do what is best for all. We must reach a point where we can recognize the rights and needs of others as well as our own rights and needs. I have a group of religious friends who claim that the answer to all these difficulties is a great religious revival. They may be right, but great religious revivals, which are not simply short emotional upheavals, lifting people to the heights and dropping them down again below the place from which they rose, mean a fundamental change in human nature. That change will come to some people through religion, but it will not come to all that way. For I have known many people, very fine people, who had no formal religion. So the change must come to some, perhaps, through a new code of ethics, or an awakening sense of responsibility for their brothers, or a discovery that whether they believe in a future life or not, there are now greater enjoyments and rewards in this world than those which have been envisioned in the past. I would have people begin at home to discover for themselves the meaning of brotherly love. A friend of mine wrote the other day that she wondered what would happen if occasionally a member of Congress got up and mentioned in the House the existence of brotherly love. You laugh, it seems fantastic, but this subject, I'm sure, have to be discussed throughout the world for many years before it becomes an accepted rule. We will have to want peace, want it enough to pay for it in our own behavior and in material ways. We will have to want it enough to overcome our lethargy and go out and find all those in other countries who want it as much as we do. Sometime we must begin, for where there is no beginning, there is no end. And if we hope to see the preservation of our civilization, if we believe there is anything worthy of perpetuation in what we have built so far, then our people must turn to brotherly love, not as a doctrine, but as a way of life. If this becomes our accepted way of life, this life may be so well worth living that we will look into the future with a desire to perpetuate a peaceful world for our children. With this desire will come a realization that only if others feel as we do can we obtain the objectives of peace on earth, goodwill to men. When the war was nearly over in April of 1945, FDR finally succumbed to heart failure after a difficult and exhausting 12 years in office. It was Eleanor's time to contemplate their children, their marital problems so long ago and yet not forgotten, their many accomplishments together. Eleanor later said, "All human beings have failures. All human beings have needs and temptations and stresses. Men and women who live together through long years get to know each other's failings, but they also come to know what is worthy of respect and admiration in those they live with and in themselves. In the end, if at the end one can say, this man used to the limit the powers that God granted him, he was worthy of love and respect and the sacrifices of many people made in order that he might achieve what he deemed to be his task, then that life has been well lived, and there are no regrets." Eleanor devoted the next several years to her work at the United Nations. Obviously, the United Nations was a very different place in 1945 than it is today. The General Assembly began with a total of 51 member nations. Today it is 191. India did not become independent until 1947 and became a republic in 1950. The question back then was how the newly emerging nations would become free, what kind of governments they would assume, and how they could solve their many problems of income inequality, economic development, health and welfare, and the peaceful settlement of conflicts. Eleanor delighted in working with young people from the developing world, who were both serious and full of hope. By custom, she resigned when the incoming president, Dwight Eisenhower, came into office in 1952. For the next decade, she stayed involved with her friends, world affairs, and political causes, particularly in the Democratic Party. A young Senator, John F. Kennedy, seeking the Democratic nomination in 1960, came to visit her in Hyde Park, hoping for her endorsement. She gave it, but not before getting his pledge to work towards civil rights issues, work that was continued by his successor, Lyndon Johnson. As she neared the end of her life, she rushed to complete one final book, Tomorrow Is Now. I'd like to read from that. So this is the author's foreword to the book. Starts with a quote from Shakespeare. "'Tis dangerous to take a cold, to sleep, to drink. But I tell you, my lord fool, out of this nettle, danger, we plucked this flower, safety." In the past, I have written of the era in which I grew up and all of the experience which shaped my life, from a lonely childhood in a caste-bound society with narrow traditions, through the crowded years of my husband's presidency, in which a Great Depression and a major war brought sweeping changes to the whole world, and finally, of the years in which I came to know a great part of that world at first hand through my work at the United Nations, to learn that its destiny, like the tainted winds now blowing over it, is common to all. More recently, I tried to set down in You Learn by Living what I had reaped from that long and varied experience. It's also a very interesting book. Now, however, I have come to see that nothing of what has happened to me or to anyone has value unless it is a preparation for what lies ahead. We face the future fortified only with the lessons we have learned from the past. It is today that we must create the world of the future. Spinoza, I think, pointed out that we ourselves can make experience valuable when, by imagination and reason, we turn it into foresight. It is that foresight we must acquire. In a very real sense, tomorrow is now. So while this is a book about today, as it will affect and shape tomorrow, it is also a book about yesterday, about our beginnings, about the history of the great nation we carved out of a wilderness, about the qualities of men and women who made that history. Above all, it is a reminder that we do make our history, and we are making it now, today, by the choices that shape our course. It is essential that we remind ourselves frequently of our past history, that we recall the shining promise that it offered to all men everywhere who would be free, the promise that it is still our destiny to fulfill. It is essential that we cast out fear and face the unknown, as our ancestors faced the unknown, with imagination and integrity, with courage and a high heart. It is essential, above all, that in making history, we do not forget to learn by history, to see our mistakes as well as our successes, our weaknesses as well as our strengths. In this book, I want to talk about the spirit of America, which is in each of us. But it is to the young, particularly, that I want to speak, to remind them of the background of our nation, to remind them that we never could have conquered the wilderness, never built the foundations of a country and a new concept of life based on the fullest and freest development of the individual, never have overcome vast difficulties and dangers if we had not had a new idea, an idea so noble in concept that it gave us confidence in ourselves and gave us the strength to build this new nation step by step. Once more, we are in a period of uncertainty, of danger, in which not only our own safety, but that of all mankind is threatened. Once more, we need the qualities that inspired the development of the democratic way of life. We need to fan the spark of conviction, which may again inspire the world, as we did with our new idea of the dignity and worth of free men. But first, we must learn to cast out our fear. People who view with alarm never build anything. And finally, I'd like to close with just a few words about Eleanor's work on the Declaration of Human Rights. It's essentially based on the Bill of Rights to some extent. It's very short. You can see it online. It fits in this little pamphlet. But I think it's time for many of us to consider how we fit in with the rest of the world. So with respect to documents like this and organizations like the UN, to what extent do we own this document? What are we willing to do to promote these values? I want to just read a couple of the provisions that seem to be particularly challenged or worthy of consideration today. Article 4, slavery. No one shall be held in slavery or servitude. Slavery and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all their forms. I think it's pretty well known that slavery has not completely been abolished. Article 5, torture. No one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. Okay. Article 12, privacy and reputation. No one shall be subject to arbitrary interference with his privacy, family, home, or correspondence, nor to attacks upon his honor and reputation. Everyone has the right to the protection of the law against such interference or attacks. Freedom of religion. Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change his religion or belief, and freedom, either alone or in community with others, and in public or private, to manifest his religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. Article 19, freedom of expression. This is something that seems to be greatly challenged in many places. Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This includes freedoms to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. And finally, freedom of assembly. Everyone has the right to freedom of peaceable assembly and association. No one may be compelled to belong to an association. So that's that. And at this point, I'd like to sing our closing hymn, which is number 159. If you just Google Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it will come up. There's a web page at the UN, and there's another web page at Columbia. Okay, so at this time, if anyone would like to say anything.
So I want to make a plug. If you notice on Al's lapel, there's a pin, and it represents the United Nations UN office. And about 3 years ago, the Croton Fellowship and some people from the 4th UU went down to visit their office. It's in a big building right across from the UN, and they're charged with a couple paid staff, but mostly volunteers, to promote our interests and try to add our voice to the dialogue, to the conversation at the UN. It's expected that each congregation have a liaison to that. There's another pin in front of the podium there comes back and tells us of what the Unitarian office is doing and what initiatives that they're trying to promote. And so that's a currently open position. And if you contact them, they'll feed you information, you know, to disseminate to the other congregations. So I think it's a kind of a nice role to play here for the congregation. It's something, especially we're in the backyard of Eleanor Roosevelt, we should certainly aspire to do that.
Well, I must admit to knowing just very surfacey kinds of things about Eleanor Roosevelt. And thank you, Al, for really giving this some substance and real depth. I think I hear that she had an exquisite sense of what democracy really can mean if a lot of people are willing to do the hard, ongoing work. And I also think, it's important to remember that given her origins and her background, there were so many options that she had, even at a time when options for women were much more limited than they are now, and how she embraced and dedicated herself to her own growth and the work that she did. Everything you read today was as fresh and as urgent as it was when it was written, whether it was 40 years ago or 80 years ago. So that's a little discouraging, but but again, the message is that we can do if we choose to dedicate ourselves to that.
Hi. I find it amazing, especially excuse me, having been through so many years of teaching in middle school and, children with problems that, were explained one way or another. And I listened to the childhood biography of Eleanor, who had a father who was absent and an alcoholic and who died when she was 10. And a mother who humiliated her and insulted her and who died when she was 8. And yet there was, and yet the path that she chose was to become, a really competent and compassionate woman. And I am so in awe of her. And I just thank you for bringing her to us. And I just want to say, Eleanor, we need you now.
We have her.
I mean, society needs her now.
I'm sorry, Carol. I have to disagree slightly. I don't think we should pity Eleanor Roosevelt for her. I mean, I don't know what the children, you're talking about in middle school, but let's not forget that she came from privilege, and that, yes, her father wasn't the best father, her mother degraded her, but she also was from a essentially American royalty even at that time. So that's not actually what I was. Yeah. It is remarkable, though, when you go to Hyde Park, it's really clear that the wrong person was president. Not Franklin Roosevelt was a charismatic guy, accomplished a lot, but when you go there and you see, that's not what they're trying to communicate, but it is what is communicated to me and actually these guys as well. It's sort of like, he did some stuff, yeah, and then she did all of this other stuff that just like tips the scales dramatically. And it's just, I think she, you know, that's your point, she did accomplish a lot, but it's in a sense unfortunate that, well, at least they both couldn't have been president, maybe I'll put it that way.
Well, I think it was a partnership.
Certainly, and there's, you know, the idea that she was really the president at the end and all of those other things, but that my sense, even from some of the things you said, is that she was much more of an intellectual than he was, and much more engaged in some of these things. And he was, at the end, he was a politician and not a thinker. And we probably need more of the thinker than the politician most of the time.
Thank you for the wonderful talk. In my youth, one of the things I read a lot of were biographies, and hers was one of the more interesting ones. The thing I came away with about Eleanor was that instead of being beaten and molded by those around her, she rose above that. She used that energy to elevate herself and become the person that she thought she should be, which is rare among people, because most of us become whom we're told we need to become. She was above that. I don't necessarily agree with everything she did politically, but that doesn't matter. I don't agree with any of them politically many times. She was a great person, and there's a lot to be learned from her attitude about you don't give up, you persevere. And that's really the lesson I think we could take away from her life. It's not what it is, it's how she did it. She persevered. Thank you.
I think she really worked hard, too.
I learned a lot, and it was very inspiring, but I think also it was very appropriate for us here. She, from what you read of her words, she's clearly someone who was spiritual in a special way, who found inspiration within herself in love and compassion and put that into action. And that's certainly part of what we try to do here. So I think it was very appropriate for us here. She was really talking to us.
I'll just throw in my two cents too. I'm Pam. It's her quote, right, that do something every day that scares you.
I don't know. I'll look that up.
I think that is, because that's one that I've... Oh, no, I take it back. That's Kate. No, is it her? No, that's Kate Hepburn. I guess I get them mixed up. But, yes, I'm. Thank you very much.
Did you ever see them together? They might have been the same person.
Could have been. thank you for a very well-prepared, very well-researched presentation. I was very engaged, and this is a topic that I love. She's a person I admire. I see her uncle's lineage in her, having just read a biography of him. But obviously, that spirit of service to the world and the energy. Teddy Roosevelt. That it seems to be that an amazing amount of energy to be able to accomplish as much as she did.
Yeah, I just want to thank Pam for helping out with the music. It was fantastic. It's like, so you wouldn't think I'd be able to work the Rolling Stones into this.
I would never have sung it, unless, although he did tell me that Joan Baez recorded it.
Yes.
I was a little less frightened.
There's a version by Joan Baez that's almost as good as the one that you heard today.
I think that if she was still alive, the ERA would have passed.
Probably right.
Oh, okay. I was right. It was Eleanor Roosevelt. Thank you, Jerry.
Great.
Thank you, Google.
Okay.